and welcome to episode 13 of The Two Tones with Tony DeBolfo.
Greetings, Tony. How are you?
And very well, Tony Moclair. Episode 13, which we know, of course, makes it the great Cranium Millimanna.
Episode Mill. Of course, Gilbert Thornley, the man who made way for Ted Hopkins at halftime of the 1970 Grand Final.
That took a lot of
Yes, a lot of grace, and je ne sais quoi. Bert was number 13, and I seem to recall Eric Pascoe. Now, Eric Pascoe was one of those fellows that a Bendigo boy, if memory serves, who dominated at reserve grade level and yet couldn't quite make the transition at senior level. I remember him going around the 30s. He looked like an Adonis. He absolutely looked magnificent. Just couldn't quite, you know, string those senior regular games together, but wore the number 13, if I rightly recall, Tone. So,
well, yes. Speaking of not being able to make the leap from VFL to the seniors, one person who did that so magnificently, where on earth was he keeping that defensive ability? You know I speak of Liam Jones, but Tone, where do we begin comes to a forensic examination of that win on Sunday?
Look,
oh, my God.
Where do you start? Where does it end? It's like a Duracell battery, Tone. It just goes on and on. But, look, what a magnificent result. It's a postscript, put the exclamation mark on a solid four-quarter performance.
Yeah.
Probably the first four-quarter showing that we've seen from the Carlton team this season, as well as they've played in other games. It was frenetic, wasn't it, that last 2 or 3 minutes of the contest. But the game
was
like that pretty much throughout. You know, there was, I mean, goals were hard to come by. You know, the pressure was enormous. The intensity was there, you know, from the get-go. And, when Jake Wiedering socketed that ball, you know, out of harm's way, 20 seconds to go on the clock.
Yeah.
It was just such a magnificent
great bit of instinctive
finale.
Play.
It was. And it was a soccer kick. Yep. You know, he didn't gather the ball. He weighed it up and just let rip with his right foot.
I reckon Messi would have hung around. Have a look at that. What do you reckon?
Was he in the stands, Tone? I know he was in town.
He wanted to see a great game of football.
It was just magnificent. One thing I will say, I didn't hear the siren. You know,
a lot of people said that.
You know, Dave Cunningham, the Rising Star, another one this week, said that he couldn't hear the final siren. I certainly couldn't hear it. So, you know, when that ball was coming back towards the top of the square, there were heart palpitations for sure, you know, and then suddenly the game stopped. It was ours. Just a magnificent performance, and what a tribute to, Mark Murphy, the captain, the players, to coach Brendan Bolton and his assistants for the meticulous planning that went into this game.
Yes.
And for the self-belief that the players had in taking GWS, a premiership aspirant.
Well, that self-belief, I think, had been instilled in the group I said this on my highly rated night show on 3AW, Tone. I could tell in the press conference after the North Melbourne game that Bolts was spewing that four-quarter effort had dropped off. There were two great quarters, 8-1, and it had fallen away in the last quarter. And he knew the list. He knew the team was capable of putting in and applying themselves and concentrating for that four quarters. And you could tell he was filthy about the outcome. And so you throw in a week's break and players are primed, they're ready, and they're mentally ready to win and take on. And there was an obvious and apparent self-belief in the whole performance.
Very true, Tony. And I think when you reflect on that post-match press conference after the North game, you look back at it as, you know, a pivotal moment because, as you say, I think youth and inexperience was no longer used as an excuse. And I do believe that Bolton raised the bar for the team there that, you know, this must take four quarters, you know, that an effort has to be prolonged and sustained throughout four quarters for the desired outcome to be achieved, as was the case against GWS. So, yes, it's a fair point that you make about you know, the standard being set. And I just think the players, to a man, really responded to the enormous challenge. And you talked about the bye. I think that was significant. Carlton, fresh off the bye, confronting GWS, who are limping towards the bye this week.
Yeah.
And I do think in a tight game, you know, maybe that was the little edge that that Carlton needed to get the result. So, what a great result it was.
Well, can't come quickly enough for Green, I think, of GWS. Have I got his name
right? Toby Green, yes. The five missed shots.
Yes.
You know, and they missed a few early. But then again, I think back to the there were two that the big fellow missed, Cruz in the third. And I think Levi sent one awry as well.
Then
that one late in the game of Zach Fisher's that probably he should have got, you know, point blank range on the run, dead in front. That probably would have iced the game there and then. So plenty of players of both sides had chances.
Yeah.
But I suppose that is a reflection on the pressure and the intensity of the game that, you know, that players from both sides just weren't able to nail those big goals at pivotal times. There was a hell of a lot happening.
Can we talk about Cruz? It was his 150th game.
What a game.
I just don't know. He's just quickly cementing a place in the pantheon.
Yes.
He's just...
You just wanted an excuse to mention the word pantheon, didn't you?
Well, no, I think he belongs there. He's just a giant of a man.
He is, in every respect, Tony. And, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man, 150 games. And, you know, you couldn't say that it's been smooth sailing for the big fella throughout. You know, there's been so many, you know, hurdles, physical hurdles, and mental, I guess, that he's had to overcome along the way. But, you know, significantly, you know, we look at the 2017 season as the season in which he started out with the fully completed pre-season, got the body right, mind certainly right, and it's certainly reflected in the way he's playing. You know, Mumford's a huge challenge for any ruckman, but Mumford was spent.
Yeah.
You know, and Cruz kept finding a way, you know, and I just think, you know, notwithstanding his contested work, his ability to follow up and just, you know, drive himself, find the reserves to get to the next contest, it must rub off on the players that already respect him and look up to him so highly. And, you know, they do say, Tone, don't they, that the big blokes take longer to develop. Well, what Cruz is at 27, 28 now, and you'd have to say, you know, touch wood, the best years are no doubt ahead for Matt Cruiser, and Carlton is certainly going to reap the rewards, providing he can keep his body right.
Two other players. There are many players that need to be mentioned. Where do you begin? Where do you end? That's the problem we have. I'm going to mention two to you, Tony DeBolfo. Of course, Liam Jones and that incredible defensive effort, like repulsing attack after attack with his athleticism. Yes. Let's talk about him
But
Bryce Gibbs's game and his physical courage really needs to be acknowledged because it was amazing.
That's very true. And there was a moment in play where I can recall Cruiser take that, you know, terrific contested mark in the second half and Mumford trying to, you know, physically unsettle Cruiser, push him over. Gibbs was in Mumford's face. And I thought, that is magnificent to see. Good on you, Bryce. I love seeing that. And that reflects the mindset, you know, and the attitude that the players, you know, now have.
That's something that the Bolts referred to in the press conference after the game, that they're a team who will die for each other on and off the field.
Well,
and that is a big cultural difference from you know, 2-3 years ago.
Absolutely. You know, they look out for each other's backs. And I've often lamented the lack of protection that the captain, Mark Murphy, has had along the journey. I've never felt that he was really helped by the umpires a lot, but I don't think that his teammates necessarily flew the flag when he was under siege. As you say, Tony, now it's happening, and it's not just with Murph. I mean, Gibbs was in Mumford's face to come to the rescue of Big Cruiser.
Mm.
And that says a lot about the mindset of this team and the will to fly the flag for their own. And it's strength in numbers, and it's the only way that, you know, you can get an outcome in this day and age. You know, you have to have every player performing to his optimum, but being prepared to fly the flag for the common good. And that's what we're seeing across the board with this Carlton team right now.
And, you know, also being empowered to play at their best, which they clearly are. Speaking of which, Liam Jones.
Liam Jones. Look, it was just a staggering performance from a player that, it has to be said, had been performing accordingly at VFL level in defence for a number of weeks. I think he was a bit unlucky. He broke down not so long ago. Probably would have got his chance a little bit earlier than he had. But comes into the team this week and he was outstanding. His intercept marks, his capacity to get a fist into to thwart Patton marking contest, and I think his ability to cover the ground, which was probably a knockback on him for so long in his career, that we knew that he was this accomplished high mark. He can do these things, but when the ball hit the deck, he tended to be lost to the next contest. Well, what we saw was the second, third efforts from Liam Jones, and again, to me, that reflects a change in mindset. And Brendan Bolton, to his credit, put Jones back to the twos, and obviously there were areas of his game that Jones needed to work on, and I'm sure the coach would have impressed it upon him in certain terms. These are the things you have to do to get back in. Well, there's a success story. There's a story of a player that has found a way to effectively reinvent himself, where in a climate where most people thought, he was on the slippery slope.
Yeah,
to
papers
oblivion.
Have been stamped kind of thing.
Absolutely. And, all power to him. Look, Patton, was probably a player that suited Jones in this matchup. We face a different opponent this week, Tom Lynch, who absolutely had it on a platter when we last played. So this will be the test for Liam Jones. But, you'd have to think that after a performance like that, the confidence would be enormous. And let's hope he can back it up with another good one this week against Gold Coast.
Lynch's game last time was phenomenal. Obviously. The usual suspects, of course, Doherty, do you say? Marchbank continues to impress. Simo, loving it like a pig in mud. Loves a tight contest.
He's wallowing in it.
And speaking of, somebody who will just... Physical courage, second nature, and, standing up for his mates.
Absolutely.
In the navy blue, magnificent. Yep. Gibble, we've mentioned. Murph, heard him interviewed during the week, and he just sounds completely different.
Yes. What did you glean from that...
Well, I was, don't take this the wrong way, but I was taken with how articulate he is. And he was just talking about the systems and strategies that Brendan Bolton has brought to the club and just how much he's enjoying his football this time around, because a lot of the turbulence has passed, obviously. The board has done a great job of kind of imposing some stability with the appointment of Brendan Bolton. I'm not quoting Murph here, I'm just reading between the lines. And... He just mentioned that the leadership group, how deep that kind of level ability goes in the leadership group, and how that kind of radiates out to younger players who then radiate it back, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So there's just a great kind of corporate, atmosphere here at the moment.
An esprit de corps, might say.
Yeah, there you go.
That might be the thing. But, when we reflect on the years to date, Tony, we're not only, much has been made of the youth, but it's the senior players that we've all discussed here. You've mentioned them all. We've mentioned them all here this morning, that are playing, arguably the best football of their careers. I'd certainly say Cruiser is playing the best football of his career. Mm. I reckon Murph's close to it, and probably Bryce Gibbs as well. And Simo, he's just the evergreen, isn't he?
Yeah.
He just keeps on keeping on. But what we're seeing is collective improvement across the board, young and old and in between. And it's infectious. It's obviously become infectious. And a win like that against GWS will only serve to heighten the self-belief of this group. Must have now that they can, they can take on anyone any given day and knock them over.
Well, we need to, we need to mention the work of Stephen Silvani. Firstly, his son, there was a tackle he laid there that was just immense. It was just fantastic. I think it was in about the third quarter. But Stephen Silvani's job as recruitment manager, and look at this stat, if you don't mind, Tony DeBolfo.
Yes.
Carlton have their third Rising Star nominee by round, 12?
12. And when we think that for many a season, my time here, we've been bereft of a Rising Star nominee, in any stage through the season. Yes, that says it all, doesn't it? You know, that's tribute to the list manager and his department of recruiters that have obviously made canny calls with their selections in recent times. And I've said it a lot, Tone, that the destination whets the appetite, but it's the journey is just every bit as enjoyable because we're seeing the emergence of these players, and it's so exciting, to go along and watch these young blokes, pit their skills. And the thing with the young players too, they have no fear of, of reputation of the opponent that they get from week to week. It doesn't mean a thing to them. They play with this freedom, and I just love the way that they're backing themselves, and they're being encouraged by the coach and the powers that be to play an attacking brand of football. It's great to watch. And may the journey go on. It's just magnificent to see at the moment.
And if you're wondering who those three are, those three rising stars, they're SPS, who had the week off.
Caleb Marchbank.
And now Dave Cunningham.
And Dave Cunningham, he was the pickup for the selection Carlton acquired from Richmond for Chris Yaron. So it's looking pretty good at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like David's only starting out, I know, but what I've seen, he looks the most accomplished midfielder. He doesn't panic. He's a good mover. He makes good decisions and kicked two to near the weekend. And he's a nice finisher. So he looks cool to me. In fact, he just had his hair cut, and I had a look today. To me, he looked like Ben Cousins. He's sort of in looks anyway. He's half as good as Ben Cousins, he'll be all right. But a great addition to the Carlton midfield, and you can't get enough midfielders, Tony. That's the engine room, and I think we're starting to develop a nice little flotilla there of baby blues. I don't know why the media haven't picked up on baby blues again, because that's what we are. We're a young team that we're on the make, and it's just very exciting to see these players emerge.
Well, also in the acknowledgement they got in the press conference by GWS's coach after the game.
Yes. He referred to it as a 60-40 game, I think he said. That he thought the odds were a lot narrower than the pundits.
Carlton were $11.
Yeah, well, that's right. We can't bet, Tony, but it was $4.50, I think.
Good luck to anyone that got on there.
Said
that this is a team on the rise and they're going places. So
there's respect, isn't there? And there's healthy respect now from people who know.
Yes.
And that, sadly, has not been always with Carlton teams of recent years. But there's a healthy respect now for... amongst opposition clubs for this particular team and where it's going under their coach and teacher, Brendan Bolton.
Well, one place they are going is Metricon Stadium. That's next week versus the Gold Coast Suns. As we said, it was not a good outcome last time. 90 points, I believe.
It was a fair old belting, wasn't
it? Yeah. You would confidently predict the margin will be much narrower than that. Now... A repeat of that performance, I think, is highly unlikely.
I would have thought so. And as I say, I'm sure that the players will go north with a great degree of confidence. Not overconfidence, but a great degree of confidence. And they'd be, championing the bit, the opportunity of getting a chance to right the wrong against Gold Coast. Just another challenge, isn't it? Every game's a challenge. We're 16th on the ladder and we're a damn good 16th place team, I reckon, Tony, at the moment. Just goes to show how even the competition is. But hopefully we can continue to build. The Gold Coast game serves as another stepping stone and I'm looking forward to it. So just a great challenge that... and I think we can go up there and play with a little bit of freedom and really take the game on, as we have done for most of this season so far.
Do you think SBS comes back into the team?
Possibility, isn't it? It's a big ground. It's a dry track. I'm guessing. I haven't seen a weather report, but be a reasonable chance. The thing I'd say with Brendan Bolton is that he's always played players on form.
Yeah.
The reputation counts for nothing. The nice thing is, Tone, is that the VFL team has won six on end.
Yes.
So there is obviously competition for spots. That's healthy. So it'll be interesting to see the makeup of the team. I suppose anyone that was part of the win of the weekend, it would be a bit hard to dislodge at the moment. It'd be interesting to see how the team fares. Alex Silvani, obviously, I haven't had a report yet on where he's at with his knee injury. I mean, that's the other thing that it should be kept in mind. Silvani was out of the game, I think, by quarter time.
Yeah.
So they were 19, or whatever it was, 21 men, one down. Mm. And yet, you know, the back line looked watertight, didn't it? It was.
Yeah.
Cometh the hour, cometh the man, Liam Jones. You are a star.
What happens in that? Because in one of the reviews I read of the game that said Carlton's strategy was basically to absorb any thrust in the forward 50 and then repel. And it just kept, and you would have noticed how unproductive it was for GWS when they went forward.
Very true,
and
very true.
So I kept thinking, well, what happens when you introduce Kieran Byrne into that?
Well, that's true. I was thinking about this morning, Tone, funnily enough, with the return, anticipated return of Kieran Byrne, whenever that might be. Now, Kieran's, you know, cut his teeth as a half-back flanker, rebounding half-back flanker. What does that then mean for Simo or Sam Doherty? You know, does that free Sam Doherty to go up the ground? I mean, there's some mouth-watering scenarios here. Again, just to get a player as capable as young Kieran back into the team, it again gives the coaching staff another option. So that's a mouth-watering, you know, scenario. What happens, you know, with the emergence of Kieran Byrne? Who knows? But it's going to make life interesting, isn't it?
Well, speaking of making life interesting, you have the unenviable task, Tone, of giving us your 3-2-1.
Tough call.
For Carlton's one-point victory over GWS.
Yes.
Horribly inaccurate.
Yes.
But when it came down to it, it was a heart-stopping, thrilling win. And
it was.
Much deserved for the Baggers. Who did you like?
And thank you, Tone, for qualifying my call, because it is hard to, you know, you can't fit everyone in. But I gave one vote to the Jones boy, Liam Jones. I thought he did an outstanding job on Patton, and particularly given the circumstances, where he was at with his career, you know, the pressure that's been on him, you know, enormous pressure. All power to him. I dipped my lid to Liam Jones. Two votes. Marked him harshly because of those set shots that he missed. But big cruise in game number 150. I thought he did an outstanding job on Mumford. And my three votes goes to our inaugural winner of the award, Sam Doherty. Hard to go past him at the moment. He's in rare form.
He's amazing.
What a pickup he's been for us. I love watching him play. I love the way he takes the game on and backs himself. And in many ways, I look at Sam Doherty as the barometer. You know, if he's really on song, I think the players lift accordingly. And what an inspiring player he is, and what a pickup he's been for Carlton.
Wright's been a great pickup too.
He has indeed. But knows where they are.
Yes,
Matthew Wright, he doesn't miss.
I did have my heart in the mouth for that kind of cheeky, kind of dribbled goal.
Yes.
Another coat of varnish.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a mile in, Tone. And even thinking back on those little kicks, well, that was a deft kick, but then that thumping torp of William Sumner's to land.
What about Ed Kunos?
Ed Kunos was another great thread from the pocket. But then that torp that found, you know, Jed Lamb.
Yeah.
Goal side, one on one from, I don't know how far that kick went. It was 50 metres.
That was Zach Fisher,
wasn't
it?
No, Sumner.
Oh, Sumner.
Oh, yeah, it was a great kick.
It was effective.
So, you know, but what that also tells me is that players are thinking it through. We've got clever players now and players that, you know, make the right call at the right time, and that was brilliant. That was a brilliant passage of play by Sumner, and all power to him. You know, and Jed's a good finisher also. So
that's
very
a
good,
very good call, Tone.
Thank you.
Just was the bit of the old "don't get it right, get it written." It was a bit of that kind of spirit,
exactly,
wasn't it?
So
it doesn't
exactly
have to be pretty; it just has to be done.
That's right. As long as it's done, who cares what it looks like?
Now, Tone. We have a very special guest in the Two Tones shortly to come in, and this is very exciting. You'll have to tell us the who, the where, the why.
Well, yes, Tony. We'll shortly be speaking to a young writer, a scribe. Dan Eddy is his name. Was previously responsible for the book, the biography of Dick Reynolds. Now, he's taken a quantum leap and gone for different players of a different era in league football. And don't we love this lot? We're talking, Tone, of the 79, 81 and 82 premiership teams of the Carlton Football Club. Those players that Alex Jesolenko took to the top in 79 as captain coach, and then Parko as back-to-back coach through 81, 82. Dan's released this book, Larrikins and Legends, the untold story of Carlton's greatest era. And he has basically spoken to every Carlton player that was involved in that glory era for the Carlton Football Club. He even got a couple of words with Bruce Doole, although there weren't a hell of a lot of words imparted on Dan by Bruce. However, this is a great read. It tells a lot. I think if you read this book, it tells you a lot about the makeup of these players that, you know, we talk about tight-knit units.
Oh, yeah.
These were guys that really looked after each other's backs. And, you know, they delivered. They were hard men off the field. They were hard men on it. And they were part of this great era in Carlton history. And it'll be magnificent to talk to Dan in a moment about the story behind the story of this book. It was launched at Percy Jones's Hotel, the North Fitzroy Arms, recently. I had the great fortune of being in attendance, and there was a terrific roll call of players from that era. You know, we're talking players like Wayne Johnston, Warren Jones, Mario Bortolotto, Alex Marcoux, some great players all turned out. There's such a tight-knit group. Jim Buckley was another one who was there. Just Val Perovic, you can go on. Great men of stature. You know, I had the great honour, Tony, of starting out my journalistic profession in an era when these fellows were still going around. And these were days when players were still semi-professional. So they weren't living in the bubble, so to speak. So what it meant was you could actually go out and socialise with them. These were fellows that they played the game and then went to work. So there was scope for, I guess more of a rapport with these players. You know, like us, they worked as well as when they played. I think there was more of a trust between the Fourth Estate, the writers and the players of that time. You know, when I look at these players from 81, 82, you know, you could argue, you know, it was Rose Gallery in many respects. And there were a lot of things that these players got up to that, you know, weren't exactly the, you know, the greatest things of all time, things that happened off the field. But you tended to turn a blind eye to it because, they were deep down good guys and you didn't want to burn them, you know. And invariably, if you heard of a story, one of them was, you know, got into trouble, you go easy on them and you get a story as a payback anyway. So there was that, you know, what am I trying to say, that trust.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, and also, you know, the number of football writers working full-time then compared to now
very true.
You've got so many people chasing even the slightest story now, which tends to blow everything up.
That's very true. But they were a great group of men, you know, and, of course, if you're a Carlton supporter in that period of time, you would still say to this day that you were spoiled. Because, you know, this was a machine. You know, they talk about the 27, 28, 29, 30 Collingwood team, you know, the machine. Well, this was probably as close as Carlton had to a machine, I think. And I did laugh when David Parkin addressed the launch where he said the book Larrikins and Legends probably should have been instead named Legends and Larrikins because he felt that there were more Legends and Larrikins. He said he went through his list of players that had participated in those three premierships, and I think he came up with something like 27 legends, as he would term them, and probably about 8 larrikins. And Jimmy Buckley was probably a legend and a larrikin at the same time. So a great book, a great read, and I'm sure Dan will enlighten us with the story behind the story when we speak to him soon. Dan Eddy, good afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here, and we're really looking forward to hearing the story behind the story of this magnificent tome that you've written, Larrikins and Legends. It's a magnificent microcosm of league football when you're looking at this particular group of characters and personalities who were seriously good footballers too. When you reflect on the experience of writing this book, what comes to mind when you think about the journey that you've been on to write this book?
Just the bond between all the players and the staff and the partners and the, you know, everyone involved, the bond really surprised me. Some teams, speaking with David Parkin about it, and what really interested me with this story was the fact that he said how tight they were and how they were the most coachable team he ever coached, really, and the most talented. He said the 95 team obviously was a really special team, but they didn't have that bond off the field that these guys have, and it continues to this day, and that was the most evident thing that I found.
And was it David Parkin that really was the catalyst for you writing this book? Was it something that he said or that really flicked the switch for you? He said, I must write this book?
Yeah, we were talking, well, I was interviewing him for something else, actually, and we got talking about Bruce Doole, and then we got onto this team, and he started giving me a real insight into the team, and I was really surprised. I knew they'd won the premierships, but I guess I didn't know much of the backstory and much about the players themselves. So I went home after having a good chat with him and crunched a few numbers and realised that percentage-wise, winning percentage, they're up there with all the great teams of all time, but we don't talk about them like we do certainly the modern greats, Brisbane and Geelong and Hawthorn and even Collingwood's in the past, and we don't talk about them the same way. So that's why I really got excited by the project.
Can I ask you why that is, Dan? Is it, well, yeah, the simple question is why?
Yeah, it's a strange one because it's not that long ago. You know, it's not like Collingwood of the 1920s where no one's around anymore. I think there's a few reasons. One is the fact that they win one in 79, and then we go into the early 80s before they win the next two, and there's almost that decade crossover, and whether that's a strange thing to tie it in together, I'm not sure. But then they have three different main coaches during that period as well, so they have three different culture changes in a way during that period. And then even though the guys, some are quite loud and outspoken characters, but they don't pump their tyres up. So it hasn't been a case, for some reason they don't, I don't know why people haven't gravitated to them and sort of put them up on that pedestal where they should be because, yeah.
Just before you came in, I was mentioning to Tony that I can recall either Ken Hunter or McClure saying at some point along the way that you hadn't arrived as a Carlton player in that period until you'd played well in finals. Not played for the club or made finals, but played well in finals. Mm. Do you think that this was a team, and not taking anything away from David Parkin at all, but this was a team that effectively coached itself? Or you know, what credit do you give David Parkin in moulding this group of, you know, misfits into a well-oiled, you know, football machine?
Yeah, I think certainly in the middle period when Purse is sort of brought in to coach and mould the team back together after Jezza and George Harris left, the players said they probably had more, they coached more themselves then. Purse was the fun guy to be around, but whether he was that disciplined, respected figure in terms of laying down the law, I don't know that Purse was that man. But so the players, McClure and guys like that, talk about that year as being more one they coached themselves. But their understanding of what they needed to do to train well, that came early years for someone like a David Mackay or Jeff Southby came from Barassi. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, and then Jezza really took that to another level again in the late 70s at the start of this era. So he's the one that really sets the groundwork for them to know mentally what they needed to do to go out and win. And then Parkin brought a whole new meaning of professionalism to it that allowed them to win those next two. Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, let's say fortuitous happenstance whereby an assemblage of talent just arrives at Carlton and then all of a sudden you've got the nucleus or the makings of a team that wins three out of four grand finals. So if you had to identify, let's say, the three factors that went into getting this team, you've just touched on them then, but if you had to boil them down to three, what do you reckon they'd be? Or incidents, personnel or factors?
Yeah, there's this fantastic blend of players that you get. When Jezza takes over as coach, there's himself, Percy, David Mackay, Jeff Southby, even Bruce Doole. These guys are the senior guys by then. And then you've got the middle tier guys of McClure and Fitzy and these blokes. And then this young crew come in. So they had this blend straight away where because of the strength of those senior guys, they were able to integrate the younger blokes pretty much straight away they knew standards, they knew how much fun they could have without going too far. If that's a, and but they had a they had their own self-driven peer group, which we do the league the leading teams model now with Geelong and Sydney, and those guys did that. But this was an unofficial leading teams back then, so they had that. That was one of the key elements. The other another key element was the fact that when Barassi and George Harris came in 65, they taught the club that winning was the only acceptable thing, basically. Mm. So by the time, I guess, that carries through pretty much until the late 90s in a way, doesn't it? Until probably Parkin finishes up. That expectation, and outside that looks like an arrogance for because it was just an expectation that's in the club that's, no, we expect you to win every week. And that's when you're talking about the expectation to play well in finals. Wayne Johnston and Wayne Harms say that. It was a non-negotiable. You if you played for Carlton and you wanted to keep playing for Carlton, you better perform on the big game. So there's a whole peer thing. There's a culture thing that's come through with Barassi. The third one, the mateship off the field is pretty unique what they've got. So the larrikin side of it, when they'd hit the town and Wayne Johnston was at a nightclub before the 79 grand final, the Friday night.
And the perfect lead-in.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah, that's right. He said, I didn't drink though.
He
said, I went home and watched footy marathon and went to bed. But I'm not sure about that. But
no, yes. That's a fair call. Now, am I right in saying that you got to pretty much all of the players that featured in this, you know, this glory era of Carlton history, including the great Bruce Doyle? And I know, you know, Bruce wasn't exactly, you know, overly forthcoming what he said. Can you tell the story about your dealings with the great man?
Yeah, I will, yeah. There's 58 guys who played one game at least in that 79 to 82 period, that four-year period. So I tried to get to 58. Sadly, Dennis Collins has passed away, so there's 57. I probably got to about 50. There's a couple that were a bit hard to, didn't like answering their phone, but I got to a majority, which was great. Guys that played one game and guys that played 90 games in that four-year period. Jeff Southby teed up Bruce Doyle for me, so you can imagine how excited I was. Oh. This was going to be the coup of the year.
Yeah.
He said, he'll ring you tomorrow. So I had the phone, didn't leave my side all day. And I put off going to the toilet. I put off, no one else was allowed to ring me. Yeah. At 5 minutes to five, I was busting, so I went to the toilet. Should have took it with me. Yep. I literally came back 3 minutes later, and there's a message on my phone. I could not believe it.
A message? Was it just silence?
That's what I was expecting, but it was. I've still got it saved somewhere, actually. I'll never delete it. It just said, oh, look, Dan, I really appreciate the offer, but I've had to think about it, and I don't think I want to contribute, but good luck with your project. And
Bruce.
Yeah, I was half shattered and half thrilled by
it. I still think that's a good get. In my opinion, that's a very good get. But look, it was very interesting to hear you talk about that. I mean, the sheer mass of players that you got to. Mm. Who didn't you get to? Was there a reason for that? Or?
There's a couple that we couldn't find numbers for. Southby and I had everyone on the case and we just could not.
They might be listening, you know.
I hope
they
are.
Probably a bit late for you.
It is,
but it'd be nice to get there.
No, there's always a reprint.
There is definitely, always a reprint.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Just going through it, there's only a handful from the start. Peter Fitzpatrick was one I couldn't track down for some reason.
Any relation?
No, he's not actually.
Okay. No, don't believe so.
Different build, different. I'm not sure where he came from. Yeah, we just couldn't find Peter.
Yep.
We couldn't find Steve Easton. He only played the one game, but it would have been fantastic just to get him.
Northern Suburbs boy, I reckon I could have helped you there.
Oh, damn. Rod.
Now you say.
Right. Rod Gold was one I could
have. Really? He's up Queensland, I think. Oh, he's on,
Spook, yeah, that's
yep.
right.
Yep.
There's a couple more, but
That's a damn fine effort, though.
I got Rowan Burke, but I got the rest.
Yeah. And they were all forthcoming. They were happy to cooperate.
Brilliant, yeah. The guys from one game, you know, Rob Dutton might have played one game. And Rob was a lovely bloke. And then Fitzy and Dooley played 90-odd games. They were the leaders in that games category. But, everyone, guys like Brendan Hartney, who probably could have gone on and played a great career at another club, but just happened to be at Carlton, and the opportunities, he won something like 7 Bendigo Best and Fairest or something. Right. You know, he was this, so they had, it was surprised me, there's just so many great players. I got to Lance Whitnell's dad, Graham, who was, he played a couple of games in this era.
Maryborough,
And even guys like David Glascott, Molly Meldrum, Paul Meldrum, he only came in right at the end, and same with Spiro Koukoumalos, but I got to them as well, even though they might have just played a couple of games at the end of that era.
And there was such a great roll call of players at the launch at the North Fitzroy Arms, Percy's Pub, which, again, I think illustrated exactly what you've said here today about the mateship that exists between this group. Mm. It is rather unique, isn't it, that they're so tight-knit, this group, and it's, 35 years after the event?
Yeah, it's amazing. David Parkin, you know how he does his rides for prostate cancer around the state, must do that every year. And a couple of years ago he was doing, and there was a Melbourne Cup Day. So, you know, it's hard to get blokes on a Melbourne Cup Day as it is, but he's having a function in Bendigo, and he just put the feeler out to a few of the players, hoping a couple might turn up for this function and talk, and he said something like 15 turned up. And Marku just wasn't on that list, and he turned up anyway. You know, they just love, he said he'll ring them, he'll be sitting at home and 10 blokes will ring him. You know, they'll be together and they just want to speak to the coach, so they just ring him. And so it's a really, so as you saw at the launch, I mean, we had... there might have been 15 or 20 of the guys that... it was the middle of the day, so they took work off and just dropped in, and there was a few that hung around later on. Wow and Marku was still there when Perth kicked them out, I think.
Right. I want to ask you about that. That the off-field, let's call them shenanigans, you don't see players indulge in that. There's this horrible almost self-consciousness now about... Mm. You know, if a player is reported having had a few too many out, and then there's the requisite public apology and humiliation for a young man in his 20s having too much beer, which I think is ludicrous. There's nothing wrong with that. Go out and do it. Just don't hurt anyone in the process.
Yeah.
What story comes to mind when you think about these guys and their off-field antics?
Probably how they had to keep swapping pubs because David Parkin kept spying on them. So he'd say, I don't want to see you at that pub anymore. So McClure said, okay, we'll go to another pub. So there was a bit of rings and rings of Rosie trying to keep up with him.
It went from Norton's down to the university hotel and everywhere. But great. And there is a story, Dan, could you relate about the day Jimmy Buckley returned to the club late for training after a midweek race meeting?
Oh, yes. What was that again?
He had a bit of a collect, hadn't he? And they called him in.
Yeah, he was getting. Yeah, who was the who would have been the staff that would have called him?
Lofts.
Oh, Wes would have called him in. He was going to give him the what for being late and hungover, perhaps.
And he reached into his coat. He said, "Wes said we're going to have to find you, Jim." And he reached into his top coat and pulled out 20,000, threw on the table, and said, "Take what you want."
He was a hard man to get, Jim. It took me a long time to get to Jim, but I eventually was able to track him down.
Yeah.
And it was, he's fantastic. His efforts to play in the 82 grand final deserve a little story on their own.
Well, he was best and fairest in a premiership year, and he battled with glandular fever. And did he tell you the story about he broke his thumb?
Yep.
And he had a cast made. Do you know that story? The final cast. Because I asked him in the 82 grand final when the all in brawl starts. Mm. There's a moment where Robert Wiley tries to take off Ken Sheldon's head, and misses. Ken sort of ducks, and Wiley sort of falls over the top. The momentum carries him onto the deck. From right of screen on the tell, you see Jay Buckley walking and look over the shoulder to see where the umpire is. And obviously the umpire wasn't looking. Yeah. So Jimmy goes over and actually sinks the slipper.
Really?
Robert Wiley. Mm. And I years later, I caught up with Jimmy and I said, Jimmy, the incident with Robert Wiley in the 82 grand final, I didn't have to say anything more. He said, I can explain everything. And he said it was because he got the broken thumb leading into that final series and was actually worried that he wasn't going to be able to play. Someone fabricated this fiberglass cast for him, and he said it was fantastic. I could mark the ball of training. It was all set to go. And he was driving to the ground, and he had the cast on the dashboard, and there was a bit of heat that day, and part of the fiberglass cast melted, and he couldn't use it. So he said the reason I kicked Robert Wiley is because I couldn't hit him. There's another story. But
there's backstory to that too. I think it must have been heading to training in at Malta because he said on the Thursday night when they went to select the team, he was in the corridor and he could hear the murmurings and he thought they're not going to play me because of this hand, and I just, because he couldn't mark at training because it had melted that day. So he must have trained the Tuesday and then it must have melted before the Thursday. And he's in the corridor and he thinks, I'm going to get dropped here. And who was the big... Jack Rout, the selector. Jack came out into the corridor and Jim thought, I'm going to have to do something here. So he picked Jack up by the throat with his sore hand and he held him there and he said, it's the most pain he's ever had in his life. When he put Jack down, Jack said, I think we'll be playing Jimmy this week. But he said it was the most agony he's ever been through.
Well, Jack weighed a tub.
Yes. Now, the story, the Alex Marco, if you've never had the chance of Alex Marco talking about going to the lodge, you've truly missed something because it is magnificent. But what... you would have heard that story from a number of perspectives. Now, the team has flown to Canberra to go to the lodge. If they didn't take luggage with them, they certainly took luggage home with them, because talk about a home invasion.
Ian Rice was horrified when I told him what Wayne Harms had taken.
You want to tell us?
It was half the cutlery service, wasn't it?
Yes, and he reckons there's a golf club down his leg of his pants. One of Malcolm's golf clubs. Ian didn't know much of that, so he was horrified. But Ian had warned the Prime Minister that you're making a mistake inviting them up because they're going to get pretty drunk and play up. But he didn't think they were going to walk out with half the cutlery. They said the second time they went back, it was all paper plates and everything, so they'd learnt. But they were apparently the first sports team invited to the lodge, the first Australian. We know America, they do it every year with the Super Bowl and everything. They were the first team that were actually invited to the Prime Minister's residence. So
because of that, the last.
Yes.
But there is a rather risque story about that involving Alex Marcoux. Yes. But Alex, to his credit, at your launch, said, I could talk about that, but it's all in the book.
Oh, good man. The book. Well,
so
there we go.
Our listeners, buy the book to learn that story. Dan, before we round up and changing tack, I understand you're writing a thesis on the life of Alex Jesolenko. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's hard. When I say to people I'm doing a PhD on Jeso, they laugh at me. They don't believe that's true. But, it's a fascinating. As you know, it's probably the greatest story in footy with the whole backstory and what he achieved. So, and also, as you know, Jeso probably doesn't open up a lot anymore, so the fact that he's been willing to open up his life to me has been huge for the club's records and for my project. His daughters have been fantastic, and we're really delving into his family history. I've tracked down all his school friends and people that he hasn't seen for a long time, and so through Federation University we're putting together a nice... Jez is the main topic of the project, and then we look at what's happening around his time in the game, and pretty tumultuous time during the 80s, and he experiences sackings and different things, and so there's a lot to look into, and obviously his migrant journey is a book in itself. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Amazing story. All power to you for that.
And how far through it are you? When do we see it? It's going to be, 40,000 words or so?
No,
or more?
Closer to 100, yeah.
100? Wow.
I'd like to have it written within the next 12 months, but I've probably got 2 years tops to have it done by, so I got a scholarship through Federation University to do it, so a 3-year scholarship. So I'm heading to Europe next month to go to where he was born in Salzburg and check a few things out there and just get a feel for where he was born, in a prison camp in Salzburg. So it's quite a remarkable story. Comes out here and he's in a camp at Canberra for another... I think he's 7 or 8 or 9 even before he's living outside of camps. So it's a really amazing... And he doesn't touch a footy probably till 12 or 13. Remarkable story.
Well, he's on the front cover here, in his last game for the Carlton Football Club, leading off the boys arm in arm with Robert Klomp and the 1979 Premiership Cup in his right hand. Percy Jones in his last game watches on. This is a must read for any Carlton supporter, well, who, like us, Tone, was old enough to savour this great year in Carlton history. any of us who lived through it will say, any self-respecting county supporter will say, we were totally spoilt. We've seen greatness on the field in this particular era. For those who weren't part of it, who young kids that have grown up in an era that's sadly been bereft of true success, I think there is a lot that they can learn from the DNA of this team, what made this team tick and what set it apart from so many other teams of different clubs along the journey. Larrikins and Legends, the untold story of Carlton's greatest era, Dan, it's a credit to you.
Yes.
Well done. It's a great thing you've done for the Carlton Football Club and
thanks,
for football. And I'm just quoting from the back of the book here, Ken Hunter, three-time Carlton Premiership player. They played hard on the field and played hard off the field too, but it had a great way of bonding the players.
Where do we buy it?
It's in the Carlton shop, which is great. And it's in all those all the main bookstores. You can go down to Dimmick, so you can... Reading's up here in Carlton. Be fantastic. Drop in there. The centre of where all this took place, I guess. Lygon Street area. So, also slattery.com as well.
There you go. Dan, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Larrikins and Legends. And we look forward to... the Jezza. You'll be a doctor of Jezzalinko.
Yeah, that's right. Who'd have thought?
Have you got a title yet? Working title be
Dr. Dan?
You beauty?
It's Ellis Jezzalinko and the changing face of Australian football. But if he ever allows me to turn it into a book, we've got an amazing story to come out of that thesis, yeah.
And the movie can't be too far
away,
we hope. There we go. Thank you, Dan. Dan Eddy, Larrikins and Legends.